this is typical of my attitude. You know, there is so much to create, so much to create. Why should we, first of all, copy the artist of the past? Second, find one day an idea and a style and just exploit it? I think that people who do that, they are not artists. They are just doing a job. You know, they found a way to make a painting and they make 20,000 and they sell them and everybody is happy because everybody recognizes the artist. I think that in that case, you are not an artist. You are just having a job, you know. It surprises people that I do not understand the content of my mathematical diagram. You know, they laugh at it. They laugh. They say, oh, he doesn't even understand what he puts on the canvas. Ridiculous. Ridiculous. Mr. Cézanne, who was painting trees and flowers and plants, was he a specialist in botanic? No. Mr. Malevich, who painted squares, circles, and triangles in his painting, did he study geometry? No.
Herzlich willkommen. Mein Name ist Daniel Fürk und ich freue mich sehr, euch heute zu einer in vielerlei Hinsicht ungewöhnlichen Episode Gin & Talk begrüßen zu dürfen. Ich habe mich für das folgende Gespräch mit Bernard Venet in seiner Stiftung in Südfrankreich getroffen. Der inzwischen 81-jährige Künstler gehört zu den international herausragendsten Bildhauern der Gegenwart. Seine Skulpturen sind auf der ganzen Welt zu bestaunen, doch er ist weit mehr als nur ein erfolgreicher Bildhauer. Er ist auch Maler, Filmemacher, Fotograf, inszeniert Musik und hat für Bugatti sogar ein Auto in ein echtes Kunstwerk verwandelt. Sein Lebenswerk ist beeindruckend und die wichtigsten Meilensteine gibt es gerade in einer großen Ausstellung im ehemaligen Berliner Flughafen Tempelhof zu bestaunen. Ich wollte von ihm wissen, wie es zu all dem kam, was ihn inspiriert und selbst in seinem hohen Alter noch immer so sehr antreibt, dass er kaum zur Ruhe kommt. Ungewöhnlich ist diese Episode aber nicht nur aufgrund ihres Gastes und dem Aufnahmeort, nämlich einem der Ateliers von Venet, sondern auch deshalb, weil sie erstmals in englischer Sprache aufgenommen wurde. Ich hoffe aber, dass das für die allermeisten von euch kein Problem ist. Bevor wir aber gleich starten, noch eine Bitte. Wenn euch Gin & Talk gefällt, folgt uns bei Spotify, Apple Podcasts oder wo auch immer ihr gerne Podcasts hört, so verpasst ihr auch keine der folgenden Episoden. Jetzt aber viel Spaß beim Zuhören. Schön, dass ihr alle wieder mit dabei seid.
Zwei Menschen, eiskalte Drinks und eine Menge Zeit für ein persönliches Bargespräch. Herzlich willkommen an unserem Bartresen. Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge Gin and Talk. Mach es dir gemütlich, lehn dich zurück und tauche ein in die verrucht düstere Atmosphäre unserer Studiobar.
Bernard, thank you so much for inviting us and taking the time for this conversation in those quite exciting times for you with the large exhibition going on in Berlin and so much work to do. Welcome to Gin & Talk.
A pleasure, a pleasure.
Let's start with talking about the place where we are right now. In Le Muy, you bought this place 30 years ago and then you didn't do anything with it really. And then at some point in time, you decided to use it for your own foundation. So what's the story behind this place?
Oh, look, originally, all I needed was a place to put my sculpture. I just wanted to have a piece of land where I just put my sculpture. I was not even looking for a house or anything like this. But someone told me that the best place in the Côte d'Azur or Provence was Le Muy. I didn't even know where was Le Muy. But he explained to me that Le Muy was very close to an exit of a highway. It was 45 minutes away from the airport of Nice, 45 minutes away from the airport in Toulon, and 45 minutes away from Saint-Tropez, you know. It's not to be neglected. But the main thing was also that it was really by the highway. And so what I did is I asked one of my brothers to come here and spend 1 month looking for all the properties around, you know, find a piece of land, nothing much, nothing ambitious. But he saw that place which is where we have now the foundation, let's say. And when I discovered that, I mean, it was such a dream, you know, the factory, more than 1,000 square meters, the moulin, the mill place where we could live during the winter, and the land was very nice. So I just got involved. And originally, I was just putting my sculpture and spending summer vacation. That was all. But slowly, because I am a maniac, you know, I always like to improve the environment around me. Slowly, I started to plant trees, to work on the grass and to make it much nicer. Until the day that the Germans again, the National Gallery of Berlin, the friends of the National Gallery decided to come and visit the place here, because they knew I had a collection and they knew I had my work around. So that day I was starting to think, oh, that's interesting. If museums are coming to visit me, you know, it's nice. Okay, then I keep on improving. And one day I started to think that, well, what about making a foundation? Because this, what you see, that property in Lemuy is really what I have done with my life. You know, it's really a fabulous site first. And it's really, you visit Lemuy and you know everything about me. You know my taste, you know what I like, you know who are my friends, you know what I collect, you know. You can have a very good idea. And I just thought it would be ridiculous that after me, if one day I die, after me, this gets sold by my kids because they have to pay taxes. So I talked to them and I said, you know what, how about making a foundation and trying to keep it as it is, but then you will not inherit it from me. You will have all the Frank Stellas, the Motherwell, the Dan Flevin, the Judd and everything will stay here. You won't take them and put them in your house, or you won't sell them to buy some Ferraris, you know. They say, no problem. This is ideal. This is what you did, and you have to keep it like this. And I'm very thankful to them that they understood that. In fact, between us, the fact that everything remains like this, we will be able to enjoy it, you know. So it ends up being a very good solution. So at the end, you know, we decided to make a foundation. I wanted to do the foundation after I die. Again, it's not tomorrow morning. But then the day that... I made this arrangement with Frank Stella where he did the chapel, you know, with those six big reliefs. And things were starting to shape up, you know, to look like better and better. Then I thought, okay, let's make the foundation. Let's open officially. So now it's about 6-7 years ago that we opened the foundation.
So if we look at your work, there are so many different things you did. Paintings, sculptures, of course, but also movies, music. There are countless different formats in your oeuvre. What is first, the concept of what you want to express or the format?
It's a long story. First, there is a taste. You know, this is how it starts. An artist has a taste. He has a tendency to look at some art that he prefers rather than the other. And when I was 19 years old, the exhibition in Tempelhof is really about an entire retrospective that starts at 19. You see that I was for sober things, you know. The work is already black and white. You never saw me doing figurative art, except when I was 11, 12, 13, you know. But after that, when my brain allowed me to think a little bit more sophisticatedly, I started to get into abstraction and into art that was relatively sober, serious, with the content. So at 19, I was already making black tar paintings, you know, paintings that were completely covered with tar. And so this is the beginning, you know, you go in that direction and then you develop something. And today, although my work looks with so many different visual propositions, it's really the same concept. The concept is that my work is auto-referential. The work always talks about itself. The work is always very, very sober. There are many parameters, you know. When I did, at the age of 22, that sculpture, which is today a little bit, you know, known, a book came out about that sculpture, a 200-page book about the charcoal pile that you can see in Tempelhof. That work already covers everything I have been doing after. It's really the beginning of it, you know, where you have a sculpture where the parameters that define what is a sculpture are completely different from what they were in the past. We don't talk, this is not a sculpture if a sculpture is supposed to be what it was before. This has nothing to do. You have a gravity that creates the sculpture. You have a fact that there is a sculpture without specific shape. That was a concept that never existed before. A sculpture that is made with charcoal, with a material which is not wood, stone, marble, or metal, you know, a different material that was never used. Then then the fact that you can go to the dealer, charcoal dealer, borrow some charcoal, put it in a museum, and then when the show is finished, you bring it back there, that goes against the concept of fetishism, where an artwork is made by an artist and you look at it and you want to touch it, thinking, oh my God, he did it. You know, no, I never do that. This is completely outside of my preoccupations. So there are many, many, many things which are changing what the sculpture is. And this is typical of my attitude. You know, there is so much to create, so much to create. Why should we, first of all, copy the artist of the past? Second, find one day an idea and a style and just exploit it? I think that people who do that, they are not artists. They are just doing a job. You know, they found a way to make a painting and they make 20,000 and they sell them and everybody is happy because everybody recognizes the artist. I think that in that case, you are not an artist. You are just having a job, you know. My attitude is not like that. And today, as you see me at my age, working and trying to still come up with new concepts, with new propositions, you have to know that it's my only goal. I hope that one day, I'm serious, one day I will do something interesting.
So there is one topic that comes again and again, especially in your paintings, but it's also kind of important for your sculptures as well. It's mathematics and science. So why is this topic so important to you?
I have no interest in science and mathematics. I don't know anything about mathematics. At school, I was the worst in my class, and I think I had a note of 2 out of 20 when I passed my exams. No, you see, I have been using mathematics just intuitively. I came to that point because, as I told you before, I was doing a kind of work which is self-referential. By doing the charcoal was talking about itself. Then I made some cardboard pieces that are exhibited also at Tempelhof, and those cardboard pieces, they are supposed to be painted by the person who owns it. He is supposed to change the color. So I'm putting a distance like this between the work and myself. And I was calling that industrial painting. Then one day, I discovered the work of the minimal artist in New York. I was 24, and I saw how much more advanced they were than me. I got a slap on the face, and I decided to go beyond and really, you know, and I made some tubes, which are also exhibited at Tempelhof. Tubes, they were an industrial product. So you see, industrial paintings, because it was painted like you paint a car. Industrial product, that's the tube. It was a tube that you find in the industry. I just cut it like this, and I presented it as a sculpture. And then one day, because I was supposed I'm explaining why I came to mathematics here. One day I was invited to an exhibition and I didn't have the money to make my tubes big enough to be noticed in a museum exhibition. I decided to make the plan of a tube, to make a drawing, a big drawing, showing, you know, the side view, the dimension, you know, seen from the top, from the side, from, you know, like an industrial drawing. So I did this and I exhibited it in the museum, thinking that if a museum wanted to realize the tube, they can realize it. I will offer it to them. But the main point is that when I saw that plan of the tube, I looked at it, and I realized that the idea of information was perhaps more interesting than the production. I thought that giving information about an object was more interesting than making the object. Everybody is making object. Everybody is making a product that you can touch and look at and so on, like the minimalist, for example. They were also making drawing, but they exhibited the end product, which was the sculpture. I thought, information, that's interesting. So I started to copy some drawings from books from one of my brothers who is an industrial designer. And I started to copy that, thinking that it was a new world, you know. By doing that, you are not doing figurative art and you are not doing abstraction. You are somewhere else. And my only goal, again, is to go where nobody went. So I was making paintings like this, but very quickly, in 1 week, I made some with chemistry because, again, it was chemistry. If I make the portrait of someone, it's about physics, you know, it's about biology. But if I make, why not paint the molecule of phenol, of something which belongs to the body eventually? You know, why not? So with this idea of the why not, Each time I was going beyond. Then one day, after making all those about 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 paintings with industrial drawings and chemistry and stuff like that, I thought, there is one thing that would be more interesting and more radical. It's to make a mathematical diagram. So I went to a shop, library, where they sell books for students, and I bought a book on mathematics, and I looked at that, and I thought, my God, why not paint that? You know, of course, it doesn't look like art, but that's why it's interesting. And I made my first painting like this, because I wanted to make it big, to show that it was a painting. It was on canvas also, to really show the people, well, it's an artwork, you know? And I did one, and I looked at it, and you know, you make one, you make two, you make three, and you are alone in the world to think like that. You know, you have to understand that. It's a strange situation. It's not like if you make abstract art like some people did already and you have your own style. No, you are the only person in the world who thinks that this is perhaps a possibility. And you are very lonely, I tell you, because you will have to convince everybody in the future, you know, and you don't know how. You don't even have a language. You don't have a theory. You have nothing. You have nothing to justify that this can be a work of art. But it's an adventure. So I make them, and I remember going to Paris, going to the galleries, Galerie Iléana Saint-Labende, the most advanced gallery in Paris. I went also to Jean Larcade, you know, who was very far out also as a gallerist, and I want to show them the photos of my paintings. But the photos, they look like photos from a book of mathematics. So they say to me, they say, Bernard, I'm sorry, but why do you show us that? I say, these are my paintings. They say, no, this is mathematics. I say, yes, but I make them as paintings also. They were laughing at me. The same way that Galerie J, which was also the most advanced gallery in 1963, laughed at me when I proposed the charcoal pile. You know, they just could not understand. Why do you want to put that in my gallery? You know, are you kidding? So anyway, but I kept on working in that direction. Fortunately, a movement called conceptual art developed like 2-3 years after. And then I just happened to be part of all that, and my work started to be shown everywhere. But you see, it surprises people that I do not understand the content of my mathematical diagram. You know, they say, oh, he doesn't even understand what he puts on the canvas. Ridiculous, ridiculous. Mr. Cézanne, who was painting trees and flowers and plants, was he a specialist in botanic? No. Mr. Malevich, who painted squares, circles, and triangles in his painting, did he study geometry? No. And so I could give you 20 examples like that. You know, Courbet, who painted the huge stones, you know, in landscapes, was he involved with mineralogy? People who were painting landscapes with waterfall and skies, you know, they were involved with, each time the history of art is made of changes in subject matter. And what I've been trying to do is to introduce that. So, but you see now the relationship between the charcoal pile and all my work, even my sculptures today, and the mathematical diagram is existing. The charcoal pile was talking about itself. It was self-referential. It was not called with a stupid title. It was not even called untitled. It was called charcoal pile. So this is what it was, and this is what you saw. And the mathematical diagram, we have to know that it's the most monosemic. I mean, it's the most, the image that talks about itself more than anything. At the same time, it's interesting to think that if you think in terms of abstraction, the concept of abstraction, and you know everything which has been created since the beginning, since 1910, let's say, with Kandinsky, Malevich, and all the others, and Delaunay, and so on, and up to today with Jackson Pollock and Yves Klein and everybody, you know. If you think about abstraction, and you look then at a painting of mine which shows a mathematical diagram, well, the fact is that you have in front of you the highest level of abstraction that a painting can present. You see how we have so much ideas about what art is, and the goal of the artist is to extend those concepts about art.
So was there this one moment, like a turning point in your life, where you realized that becoming an artist is something you can do for the rest of your life? And you also realized that it is a concept of work that would like finance the rest of your life, or at least the next couple of years?
A couple of years, it's not enough. No, my ambitions are too big. No, there are two moments. The day that I thought I could be an artist, for example, you want to know, I was 12 years old. I was 12 years old, and I in school I was not the best. I was just a kid like everybody, and I didn't care about academic studies. You know, that was boring me completely because I had a lot more pleasure going back to my house and making paintings. I noticed one day that in my school, I was always the best in making drawings and making, you know, watercolors and stuff like that. It was for me the only way to be considered, you know. Everybody, you know, was looking at my drawings with admiration. And I felt like, hey, you know, I have something, because otherwise I had nothing, meaning that I was a kid, very sick. I had asthma. I had a problem with my lungs. I was destroyed, you know, completely. Then I was extremely poor and terribly dressed. So the girls were not looking at me. They were looking at my friends, but not at me. Then I was not doing sport. I mean, nothing. I was totally outside of the real world of those kids of my age in my school, in my village. So I had no way to be different, you know, and be appreciated except with painting. And one day the big thing happened, because you have to know that in my village, which is not even on the map of France, you know, there is no mayor's office, to tell you. It's really lost. The word art was never pronounced there, never. People were just going to work in a factory to make a living, and that was it. And my mother, my father, my three brothers, my cousin, my friends, everybody was either working there, had work there, or will go work there. It was like that. So I was supposed to go also going to work there. But something happened one day. I was 12, and my mother, who was a fantastic woman, helping me a lot, you know, encouraging me to do my paintings and so on. She took me to the big village, the big city, not very big, but 10,000 people, where we could buy some oil paint, because to be an artist, you have to paint with oil. You know, so this is what an artist from the area told me one day. So we went there and we buy some paint, a red, a yellow, a green, a blue, a white, a black. And when my mother is paying, I go back outside, because in the window I saw a book big like this, a small book. And on this book, there is a little rectangle here with a reproduction of a painting. This painting shows a woman washing her feet, you know, with water like this. But on top of that image, there is a word which I don't understand. It's written Renoir. So I cannot understand. I understand sky, clouds, the table, but Renoir means nothing to me. So I go and see the man inside and I say, excuse me, what means, it's a painting, huh? Yes, and what means Renoir? And he says, Renoir, but Renoir is a very big artist. Renoir is an impressionist. That doesn't mean anything to me. He's famous all over the world. He's in all the museums. His paintings have a very big value. Look, and he takes a big book like this, you know, about Renoir, and he shows me, look, there are many books about Renoir. Oh my God, wait a second. Now, it's possible to be an artist. We can make a living with that. I never knew, you know. You can be famous. You can have books on you. You can have exhibitions all around the world, sell your work for a lot of money. Hey. Forget it about going to work at the factory, right? That day, I put all the energy in it, yeah.
We already talked about it earlier. At the age of 24, you went to New York. You moved to the U.S. How did that time change you? What was the impact of New York on you as a person?
Changed a lot. I knew that New York was the place, okay, because I was very friendly with Armand, who was, you know, living in Nice also. Martial Reis also was living in Nice. They were the new realists, the most famous artists in those days. And I was seeing them all the time, and they were coming with magazines from New York, you know, what was going on about Andy Warhol, Rauschenberg, pop art, you know, and so on. And I was dreaming, because Nice was a place where there were a few artists, interesting artists, more than any other city except Paris, of course. But we were like among each other like this, you know, having a coffee every day, dreaming to be an artist one day, but blah, 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 blah. You know, too slow for me, okay? So one day I said to Armand, look, I became very friendly with him. I was with him almost all the time. And I said, look, I dream to go to New York. I have to go to New York. I have to find a way. And one day he offered me a piece saying to me, you can sell it if you want to go to New York. So I went there, and the difference was that instead of being with my friends from Nice, you know, artists that, except for Ben, nobody knows who they are anymore, I found myself the day after I arrived at the exhibition of Andy Warhol at Leo Castelli with, you know, the pillows, the clouds, you know. And I was there, and I looked, and I see Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns, Robert Morris, Donald Judd, Andy Warhol, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm 24, but I'm saying, okay, it's with those guys that I have to deal with now, you know, to compete. And that gives you a lot of energy because you are not fighting at this level, you are fighting at that level, and you give yourself the means and the, you know, the energy that is required to do that. Now, yeah, then you have to be a little bit lucky.
But at some point in time, you took a break from creating art. What happened at that time? Why did you stop?
Well, I told you that I was working, okay, we know, with mathematics, okay. And I was doing a very, very rational kind of art. I was going so far that there is a point where I was not deciding on the artwork that I was going to present. For example, if I had a show in Chicago at the museum, it happened, we did it like this. Okay, the museum invites me for a show. I'm supposed to send one artwork, not a painting. And what will I do? I call Jack Ullman, who is a scientist at Columbia University. And I say to him, Jack, can you choose a subject that is very important, very determinant, it's in its own discipline, suppose in mathematics or in nuclear physics, and a book which is very important. Okay. And then you send it to the museum. And I don't even want to know what it is, the title or whatever. And I call the museum and say, okay, you know what? Take the title page and the content page of this book, and you make a blow up, you know, depending the space that you have available, like 1 meter, 1 meter 50, depends, you know. And then you put the book on a stand. So you see the detachment that I have with my work. I was introducing an attitude, a way to do art, which was the contrary of the chairman expressionist of today or even before, where, you know, everything is from the, you know, from the stomach, you know, it's the expression of individual. It's Van Gogh, you know, who's painting he's making his portrait every day. You can talk about the person when you see the painting. With me, no idea. You don't know who I am. You don't know anything. And I wanted to go in that direction just to see where it could take me. So when you go so far in putting such a distance between the artwork and yourself, it was logical that I stop. In fact, I had planned to stop 4 years before already. I had made a program and I said, I'm going to do this, this, and this, and that, and I will stop doing art. So anyway, I stopped because I didn't want to make a variation to satisfy myself, to satisfy collectors, to satisfy museum. Art is not made for that. An artist is just supposed to give new definition about art. He's not supposed to decorate walls or to say, look, you know, this is very nice, even if it's determinant, you know, it's a definition that you are supposed to give. So I stopped. And when I stopped forever. I said, if I start again, don't take me seriously. It's impossible because my personality, my interests, my, you know, my culture brought me to do this. And this is purely me, purely me. I cannot do anything else. So don't take me seriously if I start again. But always convinced that it's possible to go beyond ideas, at least, you know, I started to write about what I had done because nobody understood what I had done. You know, this guy was making mathematical stuff, exhibiting books without knowing what it is. You know, it's okay. So I started to write about that using semiology, linguistic, you know, different disciplines to put with words what I had done. And by doing that, I started to criticize my own work. I started to, you know, to see the limits of what I had done. And I started to think that, well, it was perhaps possible to go beyond that. And this is how, after 6 years, I started again. Now, I was not the same. You see, when I was saying, if I start again, don't take me seriously, I was very sincere. The thing is that 6 years after saying that, I was not the same person because I did only that. I was only reading philosophy, semiology, and everything. And my mind developed a lot in such a way that I could reconsider my previous ideas. And this is how I started. At the beginning, still using mathematical information, you know, the angles, the arcs, the straight line, which are chords with number of degrees and so on. But then moving every year, a new step. Today, I'm where I am.
When and why did you start creating those large sculptures? Was there some moment in time when you said, like, I want to do something really big, or does size even matter when it comes to sculptures?
No, the most important thing is to make sculpture, which is interesting. Sculpture, which are giving a new definition about sculpture. I prefer to make a sculpture big like this, but that was unconceived before, rather than making a sculpture that I have done already, making it 200 meters tall, definitely. But it's true also that if you make a sculpture like this, you don't do it for the market. Everybody wants to buy a sculpture like this, but you don't want to get into that little market of people who put a coffee table sculpture, you know. So then my work in particular stands very well if it's big like this, if it's big like this, and if it's 10 meters, or if it's 60 meters, 70 meters very soon, 160 meters long very soon again also. It works because it's so abstract, and I know how to resolve the proportions, how to deal with the space. If you put a sculpture big like this in front of a museum, it doesn't work. If you are in front of a museum, you have to consider everything, the space that you are allowed, and so you are going to deal with that. And when Abu Dhabi is asking me to make a sculpture, and I look at those highways in the desert, I love deserts also, I found ideas to make a sculpture that was starting on one side there of the highway, crossing virtually in diagonal the highway, and then here coming up. So when you drive, you see it from very far, you get into the sculpture, you drive, and you see the end of the sculpture. So you see, there are concepts like this that can be realized only at that scale.
So how does the whole process of creating those sculptures look like? We already talked about that you need a whole factory to build those large sculptures, but do you start by drawings, or what does the process look like?
No, the first thing is suddenly the brain, you know, has an idea. Last week I was with a friend who told, you know, I am working on a huge project for Salt Lake City in Utah in America. And when I showed to my friend the final maquette, let's say not final, but a very advanced maquette, he says, Bernard, you remember we were having coffee and you say, wait. And I went inside, I took a piece of paper and I say, look at that, this will be fantastic. Oh my God, you know, this will be fantastic. I made one and two and three drawings. Oh yes, horizontal, diagonal, vertical. You know, this is how it starts. Okay, then the brain gets more excited. So I make maquettes in metal. So I came here and we take everything away and we create with a big plywood, we cut it, we do all the things, and I visualize. First I make drawings anyway to have an idea of the size. Then we make maquettes. Then I take, then I make movies, you know, I make video, photos and everything, just for myself. There is no project. And then one day, there is someone who says, oh, Bernard, you should come to Utah. They want to do something with you. And I go there and I look at the space that we have and I say, look, you know, and they go crazy and then we do it. You know, that's how it works. But most of the time, maquettes, I make in steel. I don't make drawings. I make directly the maquettes I got.
Today, your art is present all around the globe. In the US, in New Zealand, Paris or Berlin, people are able to see your sculptures at important places all around the world. What does being an international artist whose work will still be visible even in 200 years mean to you?
How about 300, no? Because the steel is supposed to last. No, I tell you, honestly, okay, yes, it's a pleasure to know that I have sculptures everywhere. But you know what? You forget. I completely forget about that. What I did yesterday, I forgot. It's what I'm going to do next. And also next and where, if it's a fabulous new work that I can do. This is the only thing, you know. I mean, you will never see me saying, oh, you know what I did? I did this and this and this and this and that, you know. No, it's done. It's done, and I hope that it will last. And I never see them again. I mean, 19 out of 20 sculptures I never see again, because I don't have the time to travel and just go and say, ah, nice, you know. Never. They were only in Nice I see my sculptures. That's all. And even Paris, I don't go and see the one at La Défense. So yeah.
Would you say that the way you create your art changed over the last decades? Also the way you think about your work? Was there some kind of change in your mind or the process?
Oh, I think it's pretty much always the same way, except that more and more I can do 20 things at the same time. You know, like I do, you see, I do the paintings and they don't look at all related visually to the sculptures, which are not at all related to my poetry. Visually, or let's say at the first, first approach, I do everything at the same time. I do video, I do music, I do movies, and I do paintings, and I do sculptures. More and more, going back, looking back, and thinking, "Oh my God, I did this!" But you know, if I could do that a little bit with the experience that I had when I did this, then I improve again. Some artists have one period after the other and they don't go back. Me, I go back, no problem. Jasper John said one day, if the artist doesn't do what he wants, who is going to? You know? So no, I do, if I want to do a work like I did, but of course I will put the dates of today, but if I want to do a work like I did 20 years ago, but there will be a difference, of course, you know, I will, like I did at a certain point when you look in the room, downstairs or here? No, here. There are what I call the indeterminate lines in wood like this. Well, 20 years later or 30 years later, I found a solution to make them better than that. And I made them in steel and they are a lot stronger. These are just being restored, you know. But I go back to this idea of a line like this, very free, and I do it. So this is what, in the past, perhaps I was more into periods like this, evolving and going from one place to the other. But today I can just do everything at the same time. Not everything, but many things. Yeah.
You already told me that you're still trying to finally create something interesting, which of course you already did, at least from my point of view. But do you have an idea of what would be or could be interesting? Is there something you see in other artists' work that you consider as interesting?
I don't need today the influence of other artists, although I'm sure that it's existing, because my attitude is, if someone did this, there is no way that I'm going to do something that looks like that. There is so much to create, you know? So, but it's true, unconsciously, you see exhibition, you see magazines, you see things, you see something, you say, oh, that's interesting, then you go to something else. And unconsciously, that thing that you saw perhaps 3 weeks ago is going to liberate you for a solution in your own work. It's possible, but you don't even know. I like to think what some people say, that I have been very fast in doing things which were very new, and my work would rather have more influence on the others than the others on me. But it's true also that if I was born in the 19th century, I would not have done what I'm doing today. So yes, there is a context of art. There is a way to do art today that is influencing you somehow. But really the goal is to go somewhere else and to try to think about the art of tomorrow. You know, when I did my first conceptual art piece, again, nobody was doing that. And then today everybody is using language, you know, not mathematics. Yes, some, but nobody, but everybody is using language. And at that time, there was only Onkawara and I who were using language in a very serious way. You had artists who used language, making jokes or stuff like that, but doing something very rational or very serious, there was nobody at all. Yeah, And then when you see, like, doing a charcoal pile today, how many artists are making piles of anything, of paper or bricks or candies, you know, or whatever. So it's really that interests me. And again, as I said to you before, if I knew what I can do tomorrow, I would leave you right away and I will run away and do it.
If you do something radical new today, it's much easier for you to make it visible to the world and to get the recognition it deserves. Young artists that are not well known yet, but might also be capable of doing something, maybe even revolutionary, have a much harder time in becoming successful with their work. Do you think that's fair?
It's the only way. If you do something which is very radical, meaning very interesting, very different from what has been done, nobody is going to understand you. So it's difficult. You have to convince. And then to succeed is a long way. Not only you have to progress, you have to develop very well your work, but you have to have also the language to talk about it, you see. And normally you have it because you have to be relatively smart to do something which is completely different. But yes, but at the same time, if you do something very interesting, it's a lot easier today than it was in my days. Because today, look, there are so many galleries. There are 200 galleries in Paris, 600 in New York, you know. But the only thing is that the market has been taking over so much on creativity today that it's disturbing, and it's sometimes it could be difficult for some artists to impose themselves very quickly. But knowing that there are some art critics, good ones, who are looking for what is really for new concepts in the mind of young artists, there are also some galleries. Very good galleries who are looking for innovation, for new concepts. It's definitely a lot easier today to come out and but again, if you do something which is totally radical, people are blind and they will never see it. They will see it one day because this is how it happens. An artist who is doing something very, very new is going to have an influence on his friends because artists are always the first one to see what is interesting. So he's going to have an influence somehow. Then they become a group, you know, not a school, but a group of artists thinking like this. And then slowly they impose themselves. Yeah, I think that's how it works.
Thank you so much for your time and this wonderful conversation.
A pleasure.
Das war's leider schon. Die letzte Runde ist ausgetrunken, das Gespräch zu Ende. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Bitte nimm Rücksicht auf die Nachbarn und sei leise, wenn du die Bar verlässt. Aber vergiss auf keinen Fall, den Abonnieren-Button zu klicken. Gin and Talk ist ein Podcast von 48 Forward, produziert in den 48 Forward Studios in München.